Listen. There is nothing as exhilarating as the feeling of life coming into you. Though people look suspiciously, stand and listen. Do not go anywhere. We have been the workers, just the workers. In the Congo, one man had a land almost 80 times the size of Belgium as his estate. We have been property. When I talk about reclaiming time, I'm just thinking about my body standing in the middle of this woodland and doing nothing.
The first images that come to mind when I think of soft life have to do with fungi and how the world is constantly reshaping itself, and all the plant life and the squishy places where animacy convened.
Our overall systems are going through a huge metamorphosis, and an old paradigm, which is built around ideas of productivity and extreme individualism and fragmentation. I feel that that is now falling away, and there's a new system which is emerging.
To be able to see that living life as collaborators with us rather than things that serve us or are there for our use, I think that's the aim, really.
Soft life is part of a growing number of movements which are questioning the ways we work. So far in the series, we've seen how the demands of hustle culture have affected our bodies and our sense of time. In this episode, we look at what it's doing to the planet and the artists who are imagining different ways of being on the Earth.
My name is Sam Williams. I'm an artist at Somerset House Studios, and I work across moving image, collage, choreography, and text. I'm interested in multi-species entanglements, the ideas of bodies as worlds, and kind of methods of communal, human and non-human survival, and trying to think about my work, but also about how I act as kind of non-human centric. Earthworms are terrestrial, their skin permeable. Creatures of the muddy darkness, buriers and world makers, intestines of the earth, ecosystem engineers, a moist environment to prevent drying to pulp, ink, ghosts and dead wood. I am an earthworm. I have a soft body and I wriggle and crawl and pulse uncomfortably most of the time. Worms are a good image or a good metaphor for hidden labour, collective survival, kind of darkness and rich and fertile activity happening under our feet. I started writing about the desire for a soft body, desire for a worm body, thinking about a spin on what is desirable, thinking of softness as strength. The eternal work of the worm is unacknowledged and invisible, and they feel and flinch like the tip of your tongue when you touch them. They are quiet, quietly turning and turning their soft bodies to make our bodies possible. Growing up gay, and being considered, I don't know if I was necessarily considered weak, but feeling weak and vulnerable and soft, its associations with feminine or with... I just decided to think about these as desirable qualities, and why are they considered not desirable qualities? I picture myself an unstarry, liquid and glistening earthworm. In appearance, a small and despicable link in the chain of nature, exploring softness, limblessness, turning as labour, turning the soil. Rather than trying to pretend that softness is actually hardness. So no, softness is softness. And it's good to be soft. I don't know if being hard and being stuck in your ways or stuck in your viewpoints or stuck in your position is really a good way to survive, and how a true way to be resilient is actually to be soft.
The constant work pressure isn't really solving our economic challenges, they're just getting worse. And at the same time, you've got this huge growing impact on our environment. We know that climate change is getting out of control. You know, we're seeing all the headlines now. Wildfires in Canada, people wearing masks in New York, the skyline being ruined. This stuff is now really interfering with our lives, and we can really see it. And I think at the same time, there's a parallel in our own lives where we're experiencing just a sense, you know, rates of depression and anxiety levels, you know, trauma. It's all at epidemic levels around the world. So something is really wrong.
The endless drive for growth, the focus on expansion and productivity, is draining the Earth's resources. We know that this way of living isn't sustainable. So how did we get here?
It all comes down to our relationship with nature.
Nafees Ahmed is a journalist, writer, and systems theorist.
And at its really simplest, kind of capitalism is, you know, it's referred to as a relation of production, right? Which sounds a bit technical and weird. What does that even mean? You know, there was a time when we lived off the land. And I'm not saying those were great times because we had feudal different times of exploitation. But capitalism changed that. It created a separation where we now sell our wage labor power to other people who now owned these productive resources. Those owners, in order for them to keep their businesses alive, they have to keep growing. Because it's a competitive landscape, if they stop doing that, they just go out of business, they just die. So we're all now plugged into a system which has to go on this path of continual maximal growth, not because someone planned it in a kind of nefarious way, but just because of that relationship with nature that has changed. The system doesn't see anything else. What about oceans and ecosystems and the Arctic and the climate? We call them externalities, economists will call them, which is a very strange way of describing it, because they're not external to us. They are us.
We're locked into an economic model which alienates us from nature. How can art reposition us within the natural world rather than above it?
I've been using the sea specifically as a healer for about 4 years now. When I'm in the sea especially, I don't have any pain in my body. Like the feeling of weightlessness that you get from being in the ocean is it can almost make you feel invincible.
Natalie Sharp calls herself an octopus artist.
And by that I mean I have many tendrils to what I do.
Could a physical relationship with nature be the way forward?
Ecosex is about how you can collaborate with nature in a more intimate and sexy way. I think people sometimes get the wrong idea when you say eco-sex. They think about, you know, shagging trees or like glory holes in trees and stuff like that. And it's not that. It's more just about having absolute respect and understanding for nature. And that comes from being equal or collaborating with it. To be completely connected to nature and to be equal with nature, or to decenter yourself completely from it, is to make love to nature. And when I say make love, like, that could be just something as simple as like forest bathing, where you're like just lying down and you're looking at all of the gaps between the leaves, or mud wrestling, or just consumed by the water, I suppose.
I think of softness as precisely that kind of tenderness that I associate with plants. I'm Jason Allen Paison. I'm a Jamaican who lives in Leeds. I'm an academic. I'm also a poet and a nonfiction writer and essayist.
In his next book, The Possibility of Tenderness, Jason goes back to Jamaica to rediscover his childhood love of plants and find out how being with nature can soften preconceived notions of Black masculinity.
Tenderness and its possibilities are something I contend for. It doesn't escape anyone that when we say tenderness, it's often in opposition to manliness, manhood, masculinity. We all need tenderness. Here's a statement that's easy to agree with. Yet tenderness is gendered, viewed often as feminine. Because of this, I feel there's something to be had by leaning into my Jamaican background. Not the Jamaica that people have come to know through the media, not the Jamaica of the gangs and ghettos, the Jamaica of sun, sea and sand. I lean into my rural Jamaican culture, where stopping to observe wild plants and trees in the woodland or the forest.
Bamboo stick, mango tree.
Having an intimate relationship with plants, listening to birds, cultivating the kind of disposition that brings you close to this other world of sensing, is a tenderness that's normal for anyone to practice. I think of softness as a kind of opposite of violence. And to be quite frank, violence is one of the main reasons why I'm interested in plants. And I know that might sound weird, but I think I come to this moment in time and this moment in my thinking and writing where I see the world of plants and all green growing things really as a sort of refuge. The vast majority of plantations were near the coasts. As a Black, you know, an African living on these islands, which are enslaved, which are under the control of colonists, you know, where do you find a space that can be yours? It's often the impracticable, forbidding areas and pieces of land. When we talk about the Anthropocene and facing climate disaster and ecological collapse, it's like it's centuries of an ideology of the human being is supposed to be in control and in charge, and all of nature exists as a kind of standing reserve. It's just there for our use and for our pleasure and for exploitation and so on. But slavery and colonization is sort of like a cornerstone principle in that mindset.
Colonialism and climate are actually intimately related. One of the ways I first really realized this, there was this fascinating paper by these geographers, and they looked at how It all kind of started, the interference with the climate started with the colonization of the Americas. But they actually detected this in the ice cores, that there was actually a blip in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. They kind of marked this as the beginning of what some scientists call the Anthropocene. Colonization was actually the beginning of this very expansionist, kind of exploitative and destructive relationship with the Earth. And since then, of course, our relationship with the Earth, you know, with industrialization, where we've moved into specifically using particular types of resources, you know, oil, gas, and coal, in order to kind of grow our economies and so on and so forth, has been tied up with control of resources, which also means expansion.
My ancestors and lots of black and brown people around the world have paid the heaviest price. And so when I come to this conversation where people are talking about the Anthropocene and suddenly climate change is becoming a shocking thing, I can't help but center my history and my people as a way of saying, hey, these tiny stories that seem tiny, you know, these places that seem far away from Europe, they're actually interconnected.
I think the simplest way to understand the idea of systems thinking is to realize that everything that exists is a system. And we tend to try to reduce things to one thing to understand it. And systems thinking says, but wait a minute, how is that one thing related to all the other things that are there?
Nafees is optimistic. He thinks we're standing on the precipice of change, where the old systems are on the verge of collapse. What he calls the global phase shift.
So my idea of this global phase shift is really to try and get across the sense that we have lots of these different systems in the natural world, and we also have kind of human systems. All of the data we have is showing us that each one of them is going through these phase transitions. And we've got lots of signs of that. And climate change obviously is one of them. But it's not just the Earth system stuff where things are happening like this. I also think it's happening in our social systems, in our political systems, our cultural systems, even in families. All of these systems kind of going through this almost crisis point at the same time, I think they're deeply interrelated. And I think one of the interesting things that I've been quite intrigued by is that when you have those moments of phase shift or phase transition, it's in those times when the human choices are very, very, very instrumental at that point, because suddenly the old system is weak. I think in the past, we didn't understand this very much. So stuff did just happen. You know, cars disrupted horses, no one decided it. But I think for the first time in human history, we can look at what's happening. We can say, well, there's a global phase shift happening. Everything is up for grabs. Now, actually, we have a huge amount of power to determine what the next system is going to look like.
In his film, Deep in the Eye and the Belly, Sam imagines an aquatic future for humanity.
So another approach to soft life in my kind of current and ongoing project called Deep in the Eye and the Belly, the image this time has been whales. So there's a story of a whale that's housed in the Gothenburg Museum of Natural History. That is the world's only fully taxidermied blue whale. But in the early 1900s, they actually used to have dinner parties inside the stretched skin of this whale.
The belly of the whale was opened up for elaborate dinner parties for wealthy people who no longer retched at the putrid smell of the carcass. They dined happily inside the belly, underneath the skin pierced with stars. Couples were caught having sex inside the body, a private chamber. As he told me this, I wondered if they were ahead of their time, their sex a prediction of whale bodies becoming places for the rebirth of a population.
And these bodies are still, these dead bodies are still in motion. There's oil still leaking from the bones of the whales. So I was interested in how they're also a kind of vehicle for speculating on the future.
Remember, we met underwater, gasping, weightless, holding one another's heavy bodies. And then, breath. We learned to breathe for a second time.
And the potential for humans to return to the ocean, which is about people, the people who are left behind or who choose to stay behind in the wake of this climate catastrophe.
I think artists have a massive role to play in this because they are our vehicles for our collective imagination. And it's imagination that is going to get us through to the other side. Because when you're seeing these big system transformations take place, what emerges invariably in history is something that no one was capable of imagining before. The idea that we can sit here and predict what the next system's going to look like, and it's going to be growth, or it's going to be degrowth, or it's going to be like this, it's not going to be any of those things. Because we're just thinking within the old system and within the binaries and limits of that. And we need the power of that artistic ability to just think without boundaries.
Spume is, in its literal scientific sense, the agitation of the sea. So when there's a storm, the sea throws up a load of dead organic matter and it lands on the coastlines and the edge lines all over the world. It's this flabulous stuff that looks like belly fat but kind of foamy. It's like a sea foam. I've taken it to become this talisman thing for all of the different facets of how I have been flirting with nature and ecosex, or my understanding of what ecosex could be. I started to work out ways of surrendering myself to the sea, and it readjusts your thinking about your place on the earth and how insignificant that can be. Nature is the dom and human is the sub in this instance.
What if the ways we've been thinking about the crisis are part of the crisis? What if the ways we approach the problem is the problem in its reiteration? Post-activism is losing one's way. It's the invitation to come into other forms of relationship with the planet, knowing that the statutory and familiar ways we answer the questions of crisis is part of the crisis. So how do we respond in different ways? We need to have new affective entanglements with the world around us. Suddenly, a dog might have something to say. Suddenly, a virus is a political agent. Suddenly, things come alive and that we have to take into consideration. And then we start searching and groping for what it means to be human.
What's happening now, when we talk about this global phase shift, really, it's realizing that our entire way of being is being transformed. Because the direction of travel is telling us that if we don't kind of reaffirm that we are deeply, not just embedded in nature, but part of nature, until we do that, I don't think we're going to really be able to manage these big transformations and disruptions taking place, because we're going to keep destroying the earth and we're going to destroy our own life support systems. I think the good news is that there are these big technological transformations taking place at the same time, you know, whether it's renewable energy, you know, electric vehicles, even, you know, cultivated meats, all sorts of these different things which are giving us new tools by which we could solve a lot of these challenges. It says to me that there is this whole new potential for a new system emerging, and the old system is very much on its way out.
Soft Life originally was about challenging the ways we work. But if we pan out, the drive for productivity is having a detrimental impact on both the individual and the planet. We can't keep growing. So making room for softer, slower ways of being isn't just radical. It's urgent. We need new ways of being if we're going to survive.
Why do I think it's a radical act? Because capitalism is based on everything that's against soft life. The ultimate purpose of capitalism is to dehumanize us, is to turn us into producers. It involves tuning in to our co-naturalness. I think that's where we're most human, is when we see ourselves in the plants and in the trees and in the rivers and them in us. To be able to see that living life as collaborators with us rather than things that serve us or are there for our use. I think that's the aim, really. That's the soft life.
Thanks to Bayo Akomolafe, Nafiz Ahmed, Jason Allen Payson, Natalie Sharp, and Sam Williams. Soft Life is produced by Alana Chance and Axel Kakoutier, with sound by Axel Kakoutier and additional music by Ellen Zweig. I'm Leonora Manyangadze, Senior Programmer for Somerset House Studios.